The first dawn I experienced in Africa 36 years ago was as a guest in a girls' training school in the town of Ahuri in the West African nation of Ghana. I woke up to the sound of laughter and conversation. Looking out the open window, I saw some of the young women from the school, heavy buckets on their heads, returning from their half-mile hike to the village well where they had drawn water. It was a ritual these women and girls performed three times a day, every day of the year. 3 1-mile round trips every day for water. In places where water is rare and precious, acquiring it can be a demanding routine. And so it's no wonder that the Samaritan woman at the well responds eagerly when Jesus speaks to her of a living water that would put an end to people's thirst. Think of all the trips to Jacob's well that could save her. And so she's drawn into a rather strange ensuing conversation with Jesus, a conversation which Jesus speaks to her on one level and she hears and responds on another. She speaks of water as something the body needs here and now. Jesus speaks to her of water that will forever replenish the spirit. Their words seem to go flying past one another on parallel planes until she finally senses that there's something extraordinary about this man, and then runs off to the village as the first evangelist to tell her neighbors and her friends all that she has seen and heard. It's a strange conversation indeed. But if it is strange in its series of disconnected comments, it's also strange that they have the conversation at all. He, after all, is a Jew, and she a Samaritan and a woman, and no faithful Jew should have been in a conversation with such a person. He asks her for a drink, even though her bucket and cup were considered unclean to a Jew. He talks with her longer than he talks to any of his disciples, longer than he talks to any of his own family in the Gospels. She is a woman who has been married almost as many times as Larry King, and she's living now with a man who is not her husband, and yet Jesus reveals himself to her. He offers to her this living water, offers to bless this woman with such a gift, despite all the social and religious walls and divisions that might have stood in the way of such a conversation. Now, of course, we are not surprised that Jesus engaged this woman in conversation, not surprised that he reached out across all the cultural taboos to offer her his blessing or his challenge. We know that Jesus did this kind of thing all the time. Think about the woman who interrupted the dinner party at the house of Simon the Pharisee in order to wash Jesus' feet with her hair, much to the disdain of the Pharisees gathered, and yet Jesus blessed her with his words, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." Think of the leper who should have been in strict quarantine, who yet crossed boundaries to get to hear Jesus bless him with the words, "Be made clean." Think about Jesus sitting down at table with Zacchaeus, that despised tax collector, with other outcasts. Think of Jesus who was always crossing boundaries, always reaching out to bless those whom his society had counted as unclean, as unworthy, as untouchable. Think about Jesus who seemed always to take it easier on the marginalized people who came to him than he did on the self-righteousness of those who criticized his ministry among them. Now, such stories have been very much on my mind this month as we prepared for this day, as I have prepared to share a word of faith and hope and encouragement on this day we call Pride Sunday. In one sense, I could make the case that I am one of the least likely persons to preach on this day, an older, straight, white, cisgender man with boring pronouns, who's never had to struggle for acceptance from my family or my employers or my government or my congregation. On the other hand, as a pastor, I have witnessed firsthand the damage and the harm wrought by ignorance and fear, by civil injustice and toxic religious dogma. And so across the years, I have sought to become better at being what I can be in this ongoing struggle for acceptance and justice and standing, and that is an ally. I'm still working on being a better ally. And today I want to invite others like me to join me in strengthening those alliances as a matter of faith and practice. In any number of publications in recent days, people who experienced and participated in the uprising after Stonewall 50 years ago this weekend have reflected on those days in the life of this village and this city. I was not here in 1969. I was 600 miles and light years away, an undergraduate at a liberal arts college in the South. But the seismic aftershocks from Stonewall were felt even there, among classmates and friends who, for the first time, began courageously to decide not to be closeted anymore, but to challenge and rail against the prevailing paradigm of acceptable sexual identity and expression. Their anger was my first introduction to pride. In the years since, I've had the privilege, the sometimes painful privilege, of walking alongside and providing encouragement to those who decided not to be hidden in their deep felt love for one another, and to those whose sense of their own gender did not match socially accepted norms. To be sure, we've come a long way since Stonewall. We've indeed seen progress, as reflected in the tone shift from the defiance of the first Pride marches to the more festive and celebratory parades of recent years. In some places, new laws have been passed, court decisions have undergirded the extension of basic rights to those previously excluded from safeguards and protections. But that path from then to now was purchased at a great price and was littered with the corpses of those killed out of hatred or ignorance or fear. Howard Eflund in Los Angeles, Harvey Milk in San Francisco, Rebecca Wright on the Appalachian Trail, Brandon Tina in Humboldt, Nebraska, Matthew Shepard outside Laramie, and the three trans women recently murdered in Dallas, and literally thousands of others whose names are not as well known, mostly remembered only by their immediate families and circles of friends. When I was considering the call to come serve as your interim pastor, I heard two related comments more than a few times. The first said, "We are a welcoming and inclusive church, as noted in our mission statement and as embodied within our membership." And the second, which I'd also heard elsewhere, was the comment that First Church did not particularly want to be known as a gay church. Now, by that second comment, I understood we don't want to be known only as a gay church. We don't want to be constricted by that adjective, and we want to be broader than that. I understood that the welcome was intended to be more inclusive than just those who personally claimed initials like LGBTQIA. Our welcome was also for immigrants and asylees. Our welcome was for people of all races, especially those usually marginalized. It was for those who self-identify as nuns on the checklist of faith commitments, open to the grieving and the lost, and all those who raged against imposed definitions from anyone else. Our welcome is broad, yet we don't want to be a gay church. I understood that need for a broad welcome, But the times may actually suggest that we need, well, if not more gay churches, then at least more active and vocal allies. You've done as good a job of that as any church I know in recent years. You have gone beyond welcome to inclusion. You have embraced gay leadership and reached out to LGBTQ partner organizations. You've served enough water across the years at Pride tables to hydrate a whole city. You're allies, and you're good ones. But the need to continue to strengthen our role may be more pressing now than we may even realize. In the last few years, the assault on and the backlash against hard-won LGBTQ rights has intensified. So-called religious freedom restoration laws have been added to the statutes of 21 states now, almost half. And while such protections sound so reasonable on the surface, I mean, who isn't for religious freedom? They often mask a not-so-hidden intent to repress the marriage rights and the adoption rights and the whole host of public accommodation laws for which so many have fought for so long. Perhaps that legislation is meant to protect sincere religious faith from being repressed by statutes. Perhaps it is, but there's an irony there. Certainly, we've noticed the lack of public outcry from the authors and the supporters of those statutes when religious aid workers were charged with felonies for leaving water, life-saving water, for immigrants crossing the desert in this country. Those water bearers were certainly acting out of faithful obedience to Christ's imperatives. The silence of the so-called religious freedom advocates, I think, exposes the intent of those restoration laws for what they are: fraudulent and unfaithful to the one who's always spent more time with those at the margins, like the Samaritan woman at the well, than with all those at the centers of power and privilege. Our society seems to me to be descending into a morass of hatefulness and harm, in part because of underlying bigotry and in part because of demagoguery of some in the political class and in some faith communities. I believe we act unfaithfully whenever we try to define too narrowly the intentions of God or to limit the abundant mercy and blessing of Jesus Christ. C.S. Lewis once said, "A familiar captivity is frequently more attractive than an unfamiliar freedom." And so often the Church of Jesus Christ finds itself in captivity to that narrower way with which we are more comfortable. Most often, I believe, it happens because we're afraid of something. Maybe afraid of genuine openness to some new thing that God may be trying to do among us. How I wish we could find a way to embrace as the Christ embraced, to bless as he blessed. It's time, once again, I think, to rise up and to say no. No to hatred, no to injustice, no to ignorance and fear. In these days when so much progress is being threatened and undone, I believe we need to stand steadily and forcefully and faithfully as allies of all those who are victimized for their perceived difference from cultural norms. Ralph Sockman was one of the legendary preachers of the last century in this city. He served for nearly 45 years as pastor of Christ Church Methodist up on Park Avenue before he retired in 1961. He once told of coming home from a speaking engagement and arriving on a train at Penn Station. He hailed a cab and told the driver, "Take me to Christ Church, please." As the taxi cab driver was weaving his way through the streets, Dr. Sockman opened his briefcase and began looking over some notes for a homily he was supposed to deliver that evening. So he didn't sense the route they were taking. But in just a few moments, the taxi cab pulled to a stop in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral. Dr. Sockman looked out the window and then to the cab driver, and he said, "This isn't Christ Church." To which the man replied, "Listen, Buster, if he ain't here, he ain't in town." Sharing that story, a pastor friend said once, "Apparently there's some people out there, church folks, who operate on that cabbie's assumption, who believe that their way of being the church is the only way, and that if Christ is anywhere, Christ is with them and only with them. They try to put Christ in a box and say, if God ain't here, then God ain't in town. But God cannot be contained, friends. Not in any box, not in any hateful prejudice or assumption. Jesus is not fixed forever in narrow categories, but is always out there ahead of us, beckoning us always, as he did to that woman at the well, into a future that we have yet to imagine. It's good and right to celebrate Pride today, for so much has changed in the years since Stonewall, and there has been tangible progress, to be sure, but there is yet much to do, and the need to keep fighting for the shelter, protection, and valuing of all God's children. There's a need to go beyond being proud of who we are or how we welcome, and to understand the moment in which we are living. Maybe it's time to feel some indignation once again as demonstration of both our faith and our care for one another, and time to engage more fully the ongoing struggle for justice and safety and kindness and welcome toward that day when everyone, everyone can finally taste that living water that Jesus promised.